the newsletter that I started writing about 5 years ago. We now have about 3,500 subscribers. It's called New Creation Clergy Care Newsletter. The last issue is called Profane Temple. It's on Clergy Affair. The Journal of Religion and Psychology and the Albany Institute are going to reproduce this and reprint it. I only have about 10 copies of that, but I also have another, the pastor who's afraid to be real, and Liturgy and Wellness, but you're welcome to take a copy of that. On the back, there's an address as to where you can subscribe if you choose to subscribe. I'm not just a therapist, I'm also an entrepreneur. And here, if you wish. Also, I bought copies of my book, Preaching the Theology of the Cross. This is going out of print, and I've purchased the remaining copies from Augsburg, so I can offer this to you for $4 if you'd be interested. Father's Day is coming soon. Also, my new book, Dealing with Your Discontent, from Augsburg. This is $6.95. I only have 5 copies of that, but if you're interested, that's up here too later. I'll put an address on the bulletin board if you're interested in the newsletter. I'll be glad to send you a sample copy. Before, if you want to, you look at it in terms of subscribing. It's 4 issues for $6.50. The next issue is called The Congregation as an Emotional Unit. There's one coming up on murmuring, on criticism, complaining, whining. There's one coming up on anxiety, shame, and guilt. I'm going to deal with a little bit of that now. I forget the other one, but there are 4 issues every year dealing with just issues concerning clergy.
I would like to start this section with talking about human development. How does the self develop? And how do we develop a sense of closeness? When a child is thrust into the world at birth, the child separates from mother. Up to that point, the child's experience has been one of oneness. Freud called it the child has oceanic oneness. Whatever. The child suddenly experiences for the first time in life separateness, or at least some trauma or new experience. The umbilical cord is broken. But actually, what the child is experiencing here in autism, which is about the first 2 months of life, is not separate. What the child experiences is undifferentiation. Everything is chaos. The child makes no distinction between mother and itself. Mother, mommy, and I are one. There's a therapist that says there's no such thing as a baby. A baby always needs a mother or a caretaker. And at this point, the therapist calls the child the chubba, or the mo-child. Sort of like the bird. But the point is, there's no separation, no differentiation. The psychological birth of the infant is very similar to the physical birth of creation in Genesis 1. In Genesis 1, 2, it is total woe. It's complete chaos. Everything is undifferentiated. How does God bring order into the world? By separating the heaven from the earth, the day from the night, the sea from the land. There is only order when you have defined something, when you classify, when you have separated. The first one, of course, man given to Adam was to name every living creature. Well, imagine Adam's dilemma. Everything is generic. There are no names back. So, Adam has spent a lot of energy defining things, classifying things, separating things out. But the child, in the first 2 months, lives in complete enmeshment, complete union. There's no separation between mommy and I. In other words, the child will have hunger pains, but will not distinguish those hunger pains from mom's nipple. The pain and the nipple are the same experience. They're all one. So you can see that our earliest experience in life is one of enmeshment, of fusion. And some of the very, very memorable moments in all of our life is when we forget ourselves, when we do forget our boundaries, and we do get enmeshed with something. We have a good time. And it's a very primitive experience. Now, the first feeling that we all have when it begins in autism and continues on is anxiety, is anxiousness. After about the second month, on until about the 10th month, it is going to be different for a lot of folks. So let's put it in this. 1 to 6 months, and 6 to about 18 months,
is the experience of symbiosis. In symbiosis,
the child begins to recognize that mommy and I are not one. We are separate. The child doesn't experience that until about 6 months. How does the child experience it? First of all, through touch. Skin is so important in communicating because the child recognizes that there's something rubbing against my skin, but it's not me. So the child's first experience is not an I, it's a not me. It's something that's not me. There's some other skin out there. And the child gets a sense of suffering. Why is holding so important? Holding is so important because it gives us two experiences at the same time. It gives us a sense of our separateness, and it gives us a sense of I'm different to the skin out there that's not mine, yet I'm old, I'm close to it, and I'm close to this other skin out there. D.W. Winnicott, the British developmental psychologist, he said, we all need a good enough mother. Not a perfect mother, but a good enough mother. And a good enough mother provides three things. And one of those things is holding. So that if a lot of skin touching, the child gets a sense of self by holding. I've got an article coming out called The Good Enough Factor, in which I'm taking the very thing that Winnicott says that the child needs for finding some parental care to manage it to be a good enough factor, not a perfect factor, but a good enough factor. One thing that a good enough factor will do is hope. He will give support. By the way, he won't be supportive of anybody. There's a lot coming out in the list now. We're talking about going up to touch people that are, listening to their feelings and so forth. Well, one thing we often forget about before is I'm familiar. And my hunch is this is one of the things that they children are not being provided with. So a lot of parents care about their kids, but they're not spending time with them. And our children want to be known. This is important. And they want to know us. So without knowledge, you don't have a real good supportive community that has to be completely fair before we are individuals.
Okay?
Hold.
Hold.
H-O-L-D. Hold. Yeah. Okay. The second thing a good enough mother does is mirror for the child. The child gets a sense of separateness of a self when the mother serves as the child's mirror. Now, how does the mother do that? For example, the child looks in the mother's face. When the mother's face has a lot of pleasure and delight, what is the child going to make of herself? When I'm in mother's presence, she's what? She's delighted, she's happy, she gets pleasure, satisfaction. Now, if that child is in the presence of the mother and is a sow, what does the child think? What's the reflection? I give mother pain. Mother is unhappy with me. We always are serving for one another as mirrors for one another. And one of the mirroring affects that other people have upon us or we upon them. Do people get a sense when they're in your presence that you're mirroring back something to them of how you experience them and who they are? And vice versa. Powerful truth. That's how a child gets a sense of self. Now, what are the tragedies of child rearing practice? One thing that does not make a mother good enough is that mother will use the child for her use, and she will not allow the child to use her for his use. And that is where a lot of problems arise. Now, a part of mothers, but basically mothers have been the primary caretaker. It could also be the father. The father could be the primary caretaker, and he could be a good enough father, good enough parent. It all depends what you give the child and what the child needs. I coached Little League Baseball for 7 years. It's kind of a masochistic endeavor.
But it's not really a lot of fun. And to talk about parents using their kids for their own needs, post-school baseball, or some of the activities. The parent needs the child to succeed for the parent's pride, or whatever it is the parent needs for the parent's attention. Now, it is against nature for the adult to use the child for its needs. The child needs to use the parent for its needs. So if you have a very immature parent, a very narcissistically inclined parent, that parent can use the child, not allow the child to be used to he or she. So he's going to have to be used for my needs. That's incredible. But in some sense, we all do that with our children. In some ways, we use our children for our own needs. What we have to give is our children can use us for their needs. Very, very important in doing so. Now, I also want to say things about fathers in this case. You know, the good young mothers is important in that sense. But fathers can provide two services in the development of the child. Number one, while the mother is nurturing the child, it is important that the father nurtures the mother. If the father can nurture the mother will look less to the child for her needs, because her needs will be met by him. And I really, I'm from all experience with people, that relationship is the deepest thing. What those two people are doing in terms of meeting each other's needs and mutuality, trust, and spirit. When that relationship is functioning, you're going to do the other thing functioning again. Because if the wife of the husband is using the child of her needs, where does the child become? See, the child can find it. There did not get any needs and no help. So the father is involved in the nurturing of that child by nurturing the mother. Unfortunately, we don't have to do things like this in our premarital counseling. I really believe we spend more time on early childhood than I believe the Christian church today needs to be on a stronger advocate for children and for the raising of children and the aging of them. Knowing what we do know now about the importance. Raise up a child and raise it up, and the child becomes an adult. The child will grow up raised itself. Not when she's 21 years old, not when she's 8 years old, not when she's adolescent, but when she becomes an adult, she will grow up raised. We represent the experience that we're reinforcing of what is being raised. Now, the father has a second function, by the way. Father is not mother. So the presence of the father gives the child a sense of because my primary experience with mother is so I need the father for the experience of government, just as I need mother for my experience of husband. But what if dad's condition? What if dad is not a person who's easy to share with, or who cares, or can hurt you? Then my tendency is to what? To be chasing dad. But what I really need is dad to give me a sense of what it is to be separate, not to be too separate.
Okay, let me go back to the next stage because it's the most important stage in human development. Freud, by the way, said this stage was the most important, Oedipus. But what is fascinating, what we're finding about Freud now is all these women in the Victorian period came to Freud complaining about the sex of problems. So Freud came up with what he called infantile sex wellness. He created it. And that's how he explained all these problems that these women were having. Now we're describing, what we're discovering is that these women were talking about sexual abuse. And Freud didn't believe it. So he thought these were hysterical women, all out of kilter with their sex and creative abuses.
Which has to do with castration, anxiety, penis envy, and all this other stuff. And this was the key to life. You had to get through this section. Now what we're discovering is not.
The key to life is here between 18 and 36 months.
Because here is where the child learns, A, to be separate, and two, how to reattach once you've been separate. I have questions. What we're talking about right here.
Why does it develop at this stage?
Because in 18 months, the child gains two new capacities. One is to form symbols, to be conscious, to be able to talk, to communicate. That allows for some separate. Two, the child gets mobility, it can move. It can physically separate from others.
So those two new capacities
of being able to walk and to talk provide the child with a sense of separate. Now, we know what happens at the age of two. Children get very separate. And from the adult perspective, they're called terrible two. But in reality, a two-year-old goes into separateness is not terrible, it's helpful. It's terribly helpful because the child is getting into his or her separate. Now, if the parents don't allow the child to get into separateness, but leave the child for their purposes, what are they doing with the child? They're messing with the child. They're using the child for their own needs. And then that allows the child to get into separateness. If that is repeated in successive stages of life, this child is going to be greatly
But the key then is not only does the child learn to be separate,
but they learn to reattach. I'm I, mommy is she, and they're two separate entities. Now the earth is separated from the water, the sky and the sea, the day and the night. At least some classification definition. Now, what's also very important at this point is the third thing that a good enough mother does. Hold, mirror, and then provide some contradiction. She finally becomes a Lutheran with the kid. She creates some tension and dialectic. And it's called optimal frustration. Not that it's too frustrating, but it has to be somewhat frustrating or the child what? And try. Won't gain some new skills, won't begin to parent itself. So what's important is that there be some frustration for the child. So the child is having frustration, mom doesn't come over right away and say, let me take care of you a little deal.
Well, see if you can take care of it first. Because you can't kill the thing. You can kill something. You can kill the thing. If you're two, and then to abuse. You have to allow the child to suffer this. Okay. The next day, 2 to 4 years, we call object consciousness. What is so important here is that the child begins to internalize mother.
So that even though mother may not be there physically,
the child knows that mother exists because the child can't remember mother. Now, there are some people in our society, because of their relations at different stages of their life, who lack object consciousness. The hero that goes from bed to bed, having sex with one woman after the next, is symptomatizing a lack of object consciousness. People that bounce from church to church. People that bounce from friendship to friendship. People that kind of bounce like a ball from place to place.
One good case was the movie Alfred. There was real lack of object constancy. It's a deprivation of life. Because when you have good object constancy, you can always have that person with you through memory. You begin to internalize the person's mental representation. And it's important that you internalize that person in two ways.
Because at 2 to 4, the child experiences the good mommy and the bad mommy, the witch and the queen, the madonna and the whore, the good and the bad mommy. When she's satisfied, then she's won. Good mommy. When she doesn't satisfy me, she's bad mom. The most primitive defense is splitting. The way the child handles that ambivalence, well, mommy sometimes is good and sometimes is bad. Sometimes she gives me the focus, sometimes she doesn't give me the focus. Sometimes I have fun, sometimes I have pain. How does the child deal with that ambiguity? Split. And we see a lot of adults living black and white world. Either or thing, yes or no. Every place they go. Primitive defense. But it's prior to repression. Because to repress, you have to have memory. You forget what you forgot. That's what repression. And the most offensive way to protect yourself is repression.
And these often become very dysfunctional people in life, by the way, if they split everything. So I have to begin to integrate here. That mommy, the good mommy who gives me the cookies, the bad mommy doesn't give me the cookies, are one and the same people. They're not two different.
It's beginning to deal with the ambivalence and the ambiguity of mind. And when that's not
handled well early in life and in future times and experiences, it becomes a difficulty. All right. What begins to happen in terms of feelings around 18 months is the feeling of shame. Shame is a different feeling from guilt. Shame and guilt are feelings that only take place in a society, in a group, with another person. You don't feel ashamed alone. You're always embarrassed in front of somebody. I didn't bring myself. And I could be embarrassed. But embarrassment and ridicule are all part of this sense of shame. What is shame? Shame has to do with who you are. Guilt has to do with what you have done. You can't feel guilty until you can internalize something from the outside world. Not until you begin to internalize the maternal and paternal instructions and injunctions as to what's right or wrong, good or bad, can you feel any guilt. Guilt has to do with what you do. Now, we know, historically, that this was Luther's great problem. There are all kinds of problems with guilt. But the modern-day Lutheran pastor, his problem is more shame and anxiety. I don't find a lot of Lutheran clergy hung up on guilt. For one thing, we live in a society, environment, and context that's given us all kinds of permission to feel guilty. In fact, if you didn't feel guilty, I couldn't give you the gospel. You better feel guilty because I gave you the gospel, or you're going to be guilty. Now, this has, I think, some ramifications for preaching and teaching. Number one, we need to address people's guilt in terms of gospel as forgiveness. But we also need to deal with the symptom of sin in a sense of shame, who I am, in terms of God's acceptance, the gospel of acceptance. And we need to deal with the experience of anxiety in terms of the gospel as peace or as hope.
So there are many ways to address the gospel to people's conditions. In fact, Luther says, you know, the gospel addresses all of our troubles and situations, not just guilt.
That was Luther's problem. But I'm telling you, folks, your people, your pews, a lot of folks anxious and shameful. Shame, I feel isolated from other people when I get a touch of shame. I feel cut off from myself. I feel exposed. You know who I am and what I am. And I know what I am. And I don't want to do that. How do you forgive a whole self? We know how to forgive a being, but how do you forgive a whole being?
And that's why people need to hear the gospel as God's complete, total, full acceptance of them in spite of who they are.
Crucial to deal with shame.
In fact, shame and its cognates are mentioned over 180 times in Scripture. There are only about 35 references to guilt and its cognates. Why? Because we have an Eastern document for the most part. And in Eastern societies, the emphasis has been on shame. It was among the Greeks and then Western society that the emphasis came upon guilt. For instance, in an Asiatic family, if a child gets into separateness and says, begins to get a little horsey and acts out too much, in an Asiatic family, what would the punishment be? To ground them? To kick them out. They would experience what?
Shame, because the importance in an Asiatic family is the group. And in Western society, though, what do? We ground them, we keep them close, we keep them in.
Different whole set of values and perceptions. So the Eastern person understands this sense of shame. In fact, you know, in the Psalms, in you, O Lord, have I trusted, I shall never be put to shame. Powerful gospel statement. And there are a lot of folks out there
that are into this stuff. So when you hear all this stuff about lack of self-esteem, poor self-image, we're talking about shame stuff. People feeling cut off from other people. People feeling exposed. People that are fearful of one another. And also the same thing with a lot of anxiousness.
Okay, just to get a little breath for myself, let me take some questions. Yes.
Paul talks about separateness from sin as being separated from God.
Yes.
The
alienation, the Ephesians kind of thing, you were strangers to the household of God, that the separateness there is too much. You are too separate.
You have gone your own way. That would be the pride. I can handle it all myself. And I'm here. That's the sense of the hubris of sin. We don't have a real good definition for all the years. What does it mean to admit? And this one's talking about sin as a structure, as a system. And we have difficulty sometimes in looking at and talking about it, because we don't have the example of that. Our emphasis has always been on this side.
Jesus talks about outer darkness.
Anymore.
Well, and that's part of that separate thing, of being separated. I separate myself from God and the family.
Okay. Anyone else? Yes.
Will you repeat the statement you made before about premarital counseling, what does it emphasize?
My emphasis there was that I develop a relationship with these people, a good past relationship. That's what I would work on. I used to have this little example that I used. I asked the couple to individually come up with a scrapbook and cut out pictures from magazines and newspapers and paste them on sheets of paper, make a scrapbook. What your marriage would be like 5 years and 10 years and in 25 years, and then put some captions by it. And so they'd bring them in. Surfing in Hawaii. Candlelight dinner. Tennis in Jamaica, rum later in the evening. It was all romance. There were no pictures of conflict, no pictures of disagreements. I use that to try to illustrate, that you're really in blindness, you're an illusion, and that there will be conflict. I mean. But I don't think I can at least make them aware of it to be able to deal with it. I don't think I could train them or help them or do anything at that point. I can only make them aware of what that state is, and it's the beginning of a relationship. Yes?
What is the Jewish concept of shame and guilt?
The guilt again is what I do. The shame is who I am. Somebody, in fact, this was a non-Christian who said to me about our absolution and confession. He said, your absolution may be more powerful if you said, I announce the grace of God unto all of you, and the forgiveness of your guilt, and I announce God's acceptance of you in spite of your sin. Trying to get that into the absolution. I don't know. I'm not a Hebrew scholar, so I don't know how the Hebrews separated shame from guilt. Yes?
Okay. Ed has a crossing course called Unshaming the Suffering. And when I read that, I wrote a letter to Ed saying, that's extremely perceptive. Because in our society, one of the greatest shames that we all experience is when we suffer. We're all supposed to be successful, whole, competent, perfect, all of that stuff. And yet, suffering is one of the only things in our life that will provide the motivation for growing or for changing. I will never take away the pain of a client when they come in. Take a hot shower and a couple of aspirins and hear three Bible verses. Just to kind of cover. Kierkegaard says, the wound cannot be healed unless the wound is left open. There's just certain kinds of learning we cannot learn apart from suffering. When I lost my hearing, I couldn't believe I lost.
I'd go downstairs into the garage and all of a sudden cry. At another time, I didn't want anybody around me. At another time, I didn't want anybody to leave me. I was going through all of these kinds of traumas. And then I had to get an MRI because the doctor says you may have a tumor which causes. Anybody ever had an MRI? It's fun, isn't it? Yeah. It's really a very painful experience. They put you in a tube. I arrived there, and the man says, you're going to lie down on this thing, and I'm going to put you inside this tube. I says, no, you think you are.
Then my next question was, how long? And he said, 30 minutes. Well, it's very painful,
but you can't move, and you are literally inside of a tube lying flat on your back. And then I discovered, you know, I really don't like to be out of control. I discovered how much I like control. But what helped me was, between the picture taking, he talked to me from the outside, I talked to him. Then at the end, a female voice said to me, now be still, I'm going to take you out. Well, that was what I wanted to do. But I said to the voice, where's the man? And now, why am I going through this philosophical discourse when the thing I want to do is get out of there? But see, this was just a natural response because my relationship had been built up with that man. And I felt the man.
Then the lady took me out and he got a telephone and I was waiting to get a good job. Then I felt better about it that he was still with me. But that primitive fear of abandonment that was inside of me. And when I get into suffering,
this is what often is activated, this very primitive fear of being abandoned, that I'll be left alone. And yet I don't know what to say to you other than, and I don't remember what I said to you, Ed, but the suffering is necessary for some new learning. The suffering is necessary for some growing. I don't know how to put it. I talk about the ALC pastor who came to me in a lot of pain. I've used this at a couple of things, but it was helpful. He taught me.
I went to a Christian doctor, he quoted, and he said, if I had faith, I wouldn't feel this depressed. Well, he recognized me, he was really that guy's job. So he went to a psychologist, Christian. He said, well, if you come to our Bible study and you go into this and so forth, then you won't feel depressed. He said, well, okay. So I went to a college. How did you come? I never felt depressed. And he talked about his words. Hey, you came to me and you told me about this. You're the only person who has allowed me to have my pain. You ever don't have a major problem? It's often shameful to be in pain, right? Who wants to be in pain? And I talk to people who are physically handicapped, physically impaired. Now, often what they have to get through is a sense of shame. That somehow or other, they're lucky human beings because they're not like your car. And then there's no limit on your son kind of factory. And yet there's still mirrors of God's grace that, in spite of all the imperfections and brokenness of your life, you still can be holding the communion you see with God. And I don't know how you are to get any meaning in life if there's never been any time. That's why I think, you know, Luke's theology is fun because. To my own understanding of God. That God grace has made perfect in my wisdom.
And, you know, for all the shame, now look who I am.
I compare myself to healthy people, compare myself to rich people. What am I going to do? It's small, it's embarrassed. But that's because I was compared to people to human standards. But God does not judge us by human standards. I believe by So there's something that in that gospel that allows me to put aside the shame that I experience on time. And I will talk to people very honestly about my animal. And I didn't handle it all that well to begin, but that was me, I reacted to it. On the other hand, now looking back at it, I felt that it was pretty funny. It was rebellious. It was honest.
Did you by any chance last night and the night before see a movie called My First Name I Remember Is Jesus?
I saw the first night, but last night I got into some other fun stuff.
Too bad. Because this is fun too.
There was more pain and shame and denial and blame and interplay between parents and children than I've seen for a long time. And I would wonder what caused the initial denial on the part of the father, as we so see the thought, and then almost the total denial thereafter. There was shame involved.
The evidence of Stephen came back to the family garden. Okay, I didn't see that. Yeah. I can tell you there, where there's a lot of blaming, I know there's a lot of shame inside that person.
Yeah.
See, if you get beyond that shame and there's some self-acceptance and acceptance of others, you just find a lot less blaming.
And I think the tragedy of all this is that there was no counseling and no therapy in the state of California for a case like this.
That's good. Yes.
You're something very, very endemic to your speech. You laughed about the fact that you didn't wear a bra and you were cutting your trousers up. I think that was a standpoint of how we do that. Okay, certainly you don't have your shame.
But I do have a wife. Why didn't you remember your belt? I hope I've learned.
I've been very anxious.
It's too small, not too big.
Thank you. I was not always that way. I was a youth when I was a people person. And I know personally my growth was to get into my separateness, to get into my self-definition. Perhaps that's why I do well with those clergy who also have the same issue. I know what they're going through. I looked at myself, I've named my demon, and I can help them name it. It's very true, I don't name my demon, I'm living, I can help them name it. I'm going to become an accomplice. But the demon that only disabled by exposure. And how can you really, if I'm so covered with shame, I can't expose this thing, because what is the fear? I'm going to be exposed to you. And I don't want to feel that way. The evening after I had the MRI in the morning, my son and my wife asked me about what was it like. And as I was telling them, I was beginning to feel the anxiety that I had during those 50 minutes. I'm a lot of anxiety. I thought I was going to just bash that thing and ask him to take me out. And I said to my wife and my son, I can't tell you anymore because I'm getting those feelings and I don't want to feel those feelings I had this morning. It's gone on. Now I understand what happened to you. I won't feel that again, that which I felt once before. It was so tremendous, so painful. I won't feel it. So you just close it down. You see, what happens with shame is, I don't want to feel that shame, except it's really thinning spirit. And I'll do anything if I don't feel shame. All I can say is, you know, from my own personal, I had to learn just to move beyond it. I could very easily get into it. I'm giving my own. And I think that happens to a lot of people. There are people who don't have their separateness, which goes back again to that period of life, and are afraid of being exposed, so they're covered up, and try to please and act to each other. And then we need to think of their own power and wonder of who they are. Did you hear that? Yes,
right?
I'm sorry, Fred, I didn't hear you.
I think Freud talked a lot about infantile sexuality, and his colleagues didn't believe it. But he came to the point where he recognized that he was a baby and had sexual feelings. And I guess what I'm getting at is I don't quite understand the shame a whole lot. I understand what it means not to have accomplished much in life, not to have done much with your gift, not to have lived up to what your parents and taught and everybody expected.
Thank you.
whole philosophy of soul and moment of purification versus, you know, whatever, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Are you making a statement, Fred? You're asking a question.
Well, you had a lot of experience, with people. And I'm wondering, how do you minister to all of them? Second, is there a stand that pastors ought to take on women's issues? And that is to involve unwanted pregnancy and carrying them to term. And at what point is it permissible, or is it called into the world time? Or is this part of the community of faith? But then, if you're Christian, you're going to be against this, or whatever.
Yeah. I can't answer all of that because, you know, you took such simple examples, little stuff. The walls may explode any minute now. But to put it in relationship to shame, again, it depends upon how I view that. I mean, there are some homosexuals that do not have shame. They have accepted their homosexuality. That's who they are, and that's their disposition sexually. They don't have shame. By the way, there can be some heterosexuals that do have shame, because they've really never had a good heterosexual relationship and feel very embarrassed about it and feel very insignificant because they haven't. So it can work. That can work both ways. It doesn't mean you have to be a homosexual. It's the same thing about the abortion issue. The woman who may have it or the woman who doesn't, it gets bound to the individual. What is the individual internalized? How does the individual perceive it? And the first thing I have to do as a therapist, you see, and I'm very careful when someone comes to see me, whether they're coming to see me as a therapist or a cancer counselor. I think they are distinct roles. There's times when the two can come together, but I don't want to confuse them any more than long gospel, because it can cause a lot of problems. Because as a therapist, I'm interested in their awareness, providing them beginning some gaps of who they are, to make some very important psychic changes and what do they want to change, to do some real strong interacting with them instead of some stimulation tests. So if somebody's coming to me and have a sense of shame, like a 62-year-old pastor did last year, when he was 12 years old, his stepbrother had oral sex with. It was the first time he told me about it. I was at 12, he told me when he was 62, 50 years. And he said, you know, my whole life I've lived with all the same, I just, people know me as an angry person. And I said to him, you know, what shame you've carried with him. He finally got a sense that what he was dealing with was not guilt, but shame. He really felt his whole essence was no good. And one of the reasons he didn't feel good was, no matter what happens, sexual abuse. I'm going to say that very emphatically. Somebody violated my boundaries. Somebody did not respect me as a self. People took advantage of it. And when you're an 8-year-old, or you're a 6-year-old, I mean, your ego, you know, is just so permeable, flaccid, that you can't resist it. Well, this human is trying to kidnap him, but lying to him, I can't believe it. And here they go. Both strong and big, they don't strong. And when they're told that Stephen got to be into a larger, or adolescent 14, 15, then he saw this guy kidnapped not the younger child, the red guy, what happened? And that's why I say I really think we should be stronger advocates for children's rights. Because somebody violated my boundaries, some respect. And then shame also is I don't respect myself. What kids do is they internalize. Most kids internalize. And some bad acts. If I had been good, my uncle wouldn't have done this to me. If I had been a better person, this wouldn't have happened. And especially when it's a parent. Especially when it's a parent. The sexual, the verbal, the emotional, physical abuse. It's internalizing the brain. And then with that comes a lot of change. See, then going into change of all the time. And I really expect people who tell me about that experience. I don't push out the old home, but they forget that it's all over. That's ingrained in their mind as part of who they have been, and that's powerful. I respect it. Now on the other hand, if I'm not
there's another aspect of shame which has to do with my relationship to God. I feel shame because I've been exposed. You know, the law exposes me to who I am. And I thought I was this wonderful person, now I see who I am. And I feel a sense of shame. But I also know God can forgive that shame. So I want to be very careful if I'm dealing with shame from a psychological point of view, or I'm dealing with shame from a spiritual or the doctrine. But yet I think the first influences the second. Yeah.
I'm
wondering
if any of
your
clients have ever tried to get rid of their shame, as was depicted in an old cartoon showing a man kneeling before his confessor. And the caption was this: "Brother, you ain't confessing, you drank up." Is that how we can get rid of some of our shame?
Well, when he said you're bragging, you're probably more into guilt, trying to get it to the hubris, to the pride, to make up for one lack of what one did. People in shame tend to be very fussy, clingy, dependent, codependent. They're people who don't have a sense of self. And that's people who are going to have a lot of sense of pride and be bragging about. The shame people are going to be more on this end. Guilt people are going to go on and not classic rule, but generally that's going to happen. The shame is connected to a strong sense of community and personal. And one of the most devastating parts of shame is I feel isolated. I feel cut off. Where do I am? And in our society, suffering is an example of often a place where people feel a lot of shame. And, you know, a lot of televangelists, there are a lot of folks on that side of the surface that have very easy answers for you, but I want people to talk about their shame. I have never seen anybody really heal themselves about shame without being close. That's the time soon. I can't think of anything else with you, but. Okay. Yes, Ed? Go ahead, I'm going to break so I get to my next session, but I'll be listening.
I mean, one advantage of being a pastor you have over lay people is that the pastor's self-worth is usually not heavily tied in to the amount of dollars he earns.
Thank God.
He was fairly successful, though, even with moderate income that he currently has. Their sense of value seems to be tied in with their salary. And their salary is very heavy, but they feel either guilt and or shame.
Yes, I do want to say one thing. They could feel guilt and shame at the same time. This is, you could feel anxiety and fear and shame. And feelings come in clusters. They don't just come always in isolation. You can feel different things at different times.
But if you feel guilt or shame because of inadequate salary and the fact that his family is getting sick from his investment down, does that tie in with his early experiences, or does society then become the parent and say we're not good enough?
Could be both. Could be both, but my hunch is it relates more to family of origin. The more I deal with people, Ed, you know, I go back to family of origin stuff because I just see it getting played out over and over again. It's just the unresolved issues from family of origin and the unexpected or unfulfilled expectations. And we're not always conscious of that. But somehow or other, it's getting triggered by something out there. And I'd see it more from what were the messages in that family of origin, what were the values there, what was important there. And now society may reinforce that, and the families are part of the society, so they may feel more shame because they tied their worth into their salary. In the back, yes.
You know, talking about so important that family origin is
possibly descendants of the worst trait of a single family on the one side of the coin. And the other side of the coin, in my theory, almost all the living birth is the child after a year of the trait in daycare centers, babysitters, and that. Does that make any difference?
Let me take the last part. No matter what mother happens to be working, the key is not always that she's working. The key is, who is she? If she is getting most of her needs met from her husband, if she's a well-defined person, what will the child experience from the mother? Good enough mother. Now, it's true, to have quality time, you need some quantity time. I don't believe these people say, well, we don't have any quantity time, but we sure have quality time. Unless they live in another world than I do, I know that it takes some quantity time to get some of that quality time. So there has to be some limit, some bracketing, some ambiences around our time that are dedicated to relationships in order to find that quality time. But again, the key is, who am I as a person? If I have my own self-definition, what do I want for my child? How my child experience himself or herself as an entity, as a person. And I won't use my child to what? Need more and more of my own to allow my child to be who he is to be. And I think that works with whether the woman's working or not working. That's an answer to that. But what was the first part?
Divorce.
I have a pastor's daughter in, maybe 2-3 months ago. Her father had been involved in an affair with the church secretary. Mother was very, very distraught through the whole situation. And he just kind of advocated from the whole family any responsibility, communication whatsoever. It just so happened that 6 months before, she was 22 years old in her last year of college, that she had broken up with her boyfriend. And she said to me, she said, you know, why should I get married? Look at my parents. Look at all the heartache my mother and I have. And she said, you know, I know statistically one out of every 51.6 marriages can't be consummated now when it is born. I listened to her and I said, you know, which side of the 50% do you want to be on? We get scrutinized very often by statistics. But I also think we have to let folks know that, hey, they have a responsibility for what 50% they want to be. That's not going to say that they're not always going to end up where they choose to be, but that can happen. It's just like people say, well, geez, I only changed about 10%. I think 10%. That's a tremendous change. We think if we're going to change, we're going to change what? 50%, 100%. I can tell you, you change 2%, 5%, 10%. You've got major growth and change in your life. And again, we get tyrannized by you are going to have a lot of folks out there, and when you get to the divorce place, they probably have been fighting this battle, these unseparateness and closeness. I would provide as much as possible, whatever you can for couples, in education course, through preaching. And to encourage folks, you know, when you're stuck, when it's really painful and hurting, you know, tell someone, let somebody know. It's okay to be there. It's a fascinating thing going on in the therapeutic world. There's a couple of spokesmen, and none of them are Christian, by the way, but a couple of spokesmen who have been very critical of the therapeutic community concerning this. There's one man said, you know, I read all these articles about anorexia. This is about 2 out of every 1,000 clients I have on earth. He says, but nobody's writing articles about affairs. And yet 50% of those that come in here are involved in affairs. He says, and all of these therapists don't want to talk about affairs because they're afraid they're going to get into value judgment. But affairs are symptomatic of disturbances in individuals and relationships.
An affair is a triangulation. A and B are not functioning, so they bring in C, or one brings in C, and the anxiety gets bound with C. Affairs are lies. Affairs are illusions.
It's a recapturing of romance. 55-year-old pastor. Oh, man, hair pastor, upright. Right straight down the line with the confessions, without variation. Ruled his congregation, 55 years of age. An affair. He said, my wife asked me how many times I had sex with this woman. He says, I told my wife 3 times, but I didn't tell her it was all in the same night. Talk about repression. And he finally said to me, he says, I thought life was all laws, and that's how you lived, and all this rigidity. And then all of a sudden, it just blew apart. He says, I've heard you at circuit counselor's conference for 3 times. And I just pushed what you were saying aside. And he said, in fact, 2 times ago, you talked about clergy affairs. He says, I almost talked to you each time, and I didn't, and I wish I had. I'm not going to say I have any magic or anything. I'm just going to say, somehow or other, that more and more of that permission that it's okay to be who you are, to feel what you feel, to think what you think, and even if it's inappropriate or immoral, you've got to talk to somebody. Because whatever is secret gains a lot of strength. It gains power. And so that's what these two secular therapists are saying. You know, the therapeutic community is being very, very false to the general public and not talking about what affairs actually are. And that they are symptomatic of disturbances within the person and between people in their relationships. And we allow folks to get too much of what affairs are from the media, which are total distortions of reality. Anybody else? Yes?
Where would you classify or put into a category an individual who wants to be dependent upon the self, and yet when the self wants to assume the proper role because it can't, they come over to this other side where they more or less like their pastoral side?
Let's put this up here. The square will be the hair pastor.
Yeah.
That's the role he plays at home too. You play
this.
Say
this would even be a woman in a relationship.
Oh, okay. Where is the woman? She deserves that. Okay. What does the woman want? She wants some dependency, some closeness, or you try to get better.
Well, someone really to take over for her.
Okay. So she wants someone to take care of her. Take care of him. Okay? And she's looking to the square now as the husband. She's looking to the husband or everybody?
She would like for, say, the husband to take this role.
To take this role, take care of him.
Yes.
And what does the husband do?
Well, when the husband would try to do this,
yes,
then she would revert to being the person who would
back there
assume the other role.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's the marital dance. That's the two lines later. That's a pursue. Okay, come take care of me. So if you come take care of him, I'll take care of that game. So then you go to take the lady said, I'm going to try to keep this man. I'm going to spend 30, I'm going to keep this man. And if you have any money to get here, he's going to take it and hide it over here. And then you find it there, he's going to take it and hide it over there. He's going to get you to keep pursuing it. See, and you're going to do the same thing. Unconsciously, you're going to collude to do this. That's your marital dance. And that's okay. But the point is, the roles have to reverse sometimes, where this person is going to take care of me, this person isolates, and then this person comes to you. Because otherwise, you're going to be dancing down a dance floor like this. You're pretty soon going to hit the wall. And when you have a dance, you've got to go this way and this way. That's why communication, you know, you have to work on each other. And you have to alternate in the world. Sometimes I need to be taken care of. Sometimes I need to take care of. Hard for males in our society to be taken care of. Because most of us are encouraged to be separate, whereas females in our society are encouraged to be close. This is not a gender issue, though. Because women have just as much need to be separate as men have need to be close. And both have to then own it for themselves. They can't ask their partner to do it for them. Now, the balance may be more on his side to her side in terms of the separateness, but the closer the balance comes that each owns this as a need for oneself, the healthier the individual is and the healthier the relationship is.
See, we have a lot of folks in our congregations who, once they get into the congregation, get into their child role. And what do they want from the pastor? Take care of me. And then there's some that really know how to play that game well, and they become what we call delinquents. And they really want the pastor to come what? Chase them. Pastor chases them. What happens next Sunday? They're in church. And then the next Sunday, they're back in isolators, waiting for the fuser to come down. You know, if I were back in a parish, one thing I'd tell my folks more and more, I say, I don't know what you need. And if you need something, you're going to have to tell me sometimes. I can't guess. Because that's partly adulthood. You've got to tell me what you need. And I have to have you often take responsibility for yourself. I can't keep chasing you. But it happens in a relationship, in church relationships. So often we get the pastor's the parent and the people are the children. Or the pastor sometimes could act like the child and ask the congregation to come take care of him. But it's just a part of what life is like for us. We need to excuse the ladies. Oh, it is 11:45.
We'll give them about 5 minutes to go and then they know.
I realize as the ladies are leaving, I'm just going to finish up the statement about pursuit. I realize there is the parables of the lost coin, the lost sheep, and the lost son. And they are pursued. They are sought after. But there also becomes a time when you have to use your wisdom. That if you're constantly pursuing people and they're never coming back in your direction unless you pursued them, you're over-functioning. And you have to let folks know that they have some responsibility in this relationship to come forward, to reach out. Okay, any other questions or comments? Yes, Dick?
You said that people feel shame when they feel pain.
That they're having suffering. Yeah, okay.
Why was that deliberate choice, I think it was, rather than anxiety or guilt?
I think when folks are into suffering, which is the experience of their pain. Suffering is not the same as pain. Suffering is my experience of my pain. I think, yes, when people are into that, the feeling they have more is a feeling of shamefulness. I should be perfect. I should be healthy. I should be wealthy. I should be feeling good. I should.
Is there room for the dimension that somebody might be anxious? Will I be able to cope with
it? Oh, that could be there too, yes. I'm not saying any of those could be excluded. I'm saying I think in our society, very often, folks get into shame when they're into suffering. You know, don't bother to come see me, Pastor. You know, I can handle it. What is that person saying? Yeah, and I really have a lot of shame. Because, you know, look at me. We feel awkward in the presence of people suffering. And very often we want them to get out of that experience so we don't feel so bad. Hand here? Yeah.
So the guilt, for instance, would be, what have I done to deserve my suffering? What kind of sin have I committed before God that you labor suffering?
That would be guilt. That because you... Okay. Shame is, you know, why did God do this to me? What's this? Oh, okay. Harvey?
I see the other dimension that in suffering, Alan Armstrong, with her being a nurse, and she says that element doesn't come through with welfare patients. There doesn't seem to be any kind of shame attached to suffering. It seems to go the other direction.
I'm talking middle class society, right? There's a greater acceptance in the reality of suffering among those who are in that situation. Anyone else? Fred?
I mean, John. Yeah. One question was asked about split families, working mothers, or single parents.
Yes.
And you were talking about the importance of the father to identify separateness.
Yes.
Is there any cultural identity or characteristic, say, with blacks, and maybe a lot of them are on welfare, or because of the fact that we have a lot of working single mothers, or fathers generally don't have children, that affects people's problems and the way they grow up and their personalities?
All of it does, Fred, in some way. I think a lot of those in the drug culture are people who are looking for attention to something and are attaching to a substance, which won't give it to what they're really deeply looking for. And that comes out of some deprivations that they've experienced in terms of human attachments. There's an author by the name of John Bowlby, a British man, who says, you know, he believes the most fundamental desire of all life is attachment. Not sexual stuff, man, just to be attached. John?
I think that you're on the Citizen Standing Committee on Pastoral Suitability. Anywhere along the line, when you do any studies or lectures on birth order in terms of teen ministry?
I think birth order can be very important. John's asking a question about birth order. Let me say, the thing that's significant about birth order, because in most families, the first child is assigned a particular functioning position. The second child, a particular functioning third and fourth. And then it tends to get repeated. The fifth child becomes like the first child. And that can have an influence in terms of how people work in staffs. To put two firstborns in a staff, you may have trouble. But it may have been that that firstborn of one family wasn't given the role, the functioning role, to be super responsible. Was given the role to be clown. It all depends what role was assigned by the family. Though we know in most families, the position gets a certain role. I'm the third of six children. I am the mediator, the pleaser. Everybody in my family likes me. I have no hang-ups with anybody. I mean, I know how to please people, and I did it well. I told you, I was a diffuser. That was my role. I go back, and I still play that role. And people look to me for that role. But I've had to learn other functioning positions because it didn't work all the time when I was outside my family.
Firstborn as an assistant to the pastor who is second or thirdborn has the potential for
this. Yes. If other things are awkward too in a relationship, correct. I just worked with a very good staff, and what we did is we spent time with family of origin, and everybody put it out. Well, by golly, after we did, we spent about 20 hours on this. They began to see what in the world was going on. Two came out of very dysfunctional families. One was extremely passive-aggressive. One was the youngest in a family with three boys. And she's the DCE on the staff with three boys. Two pastors and another DCE. Now, all this stuff that was getting played out, we finally were able to put it down. That's why I want to do this study with Friedman, so I can develop an instrument to help clergy know what it is that they're dealing with. Because I really believe if you have some awareness, then you have some choice. If I don't have awareness, I repeat it and repeat it and repeat it. Okay, we have time for one more question, too. Yes?
I wonder what you might say about some of the broader environmental influences. We're talking about kind of the larger influence that had a lot of impact, certainly. But I think, for example, of some of the research that comes out of sociological areas, like
yeah, okay, I'll comment on Bella's book. I think Bella, I disagree with the one who said, I believe, yes, our society has heavily emphasized individualism, idealism, philosophy. Practically, though, I think most of our people in society are. That's my point. So while there's an overpreponderance in terms of preaching individualism, autonomy, independence, separateness, freedom, all that, practically I think what we've seen on society is a lot of them. Because we've got a lot of broken families. We've got a lot of folks that are out there looking for all kinds of attachments. And the attachment may sometimes be to a thing, a cause, a person, a substance, a relationship, whatever. Melody Beattie's book, Codependence No More, has become a bestseller. Why? I mean, it's for the alcoholic community, adult children of alcoholics. But it speaks to all of us. We all have strong codependency needs. And we got to recognize it. And I think that's why partly that book is so important. I think a lot of us are meshed. It's very hard to be separate. Yeah, in the parable of the prodigal son, the son goes off into the far country, then into the separateness, right? Getting rid of the shackles at home. Where is the older son? He's a mess. He's a mess with that. Now, dad, look all I've done for all these years. He didn't start to talk to him. This guy goes off and mostly cuts off on other functions of his heart. And you sacrifice the cat. So you got, you know, the opposite thing. But what you get over here with the older son is work lessons, right? Look what all I have done for you. I'm expecting you to give me special attention, give me approval. I think it's a whole lot of folks. And I just say, into that immense dimension son. Not over here into the acceptance son. So that's, I would agree with Bella in terms of what he's saying. This is what media produces, this is the predominant thing, but I think practically, you know, a lot of things. And we're not going to talk about drugs. You talk about drugs. Drugs is a mention with substance. It's an emotional mention with substance. One more hand. Okay, I hope this was helpful, and I really appreciate you pushing back. I really like that. Thanks a lot.
Now,
There are a number of districts that are.
We got some material organized. I do a little commentary.
Okay. Oh, you're already at the chapel.
Thank you.